As I'm reading that, I'm sure a lot of you were thinking, now where in the world did he come up with that fish story? You have never heard it, I don't think, on Sunday before. It's not in the Sunday lectionary. It wasn't in the previous one. It's one of those stories that get skipped. If you get to come during the week, not many people's job schedules allow that. If you get to come during the week, you've heard it. It's in the weekday lectionary. It's not like they're hiding it. But they're sure not featuring it. We moved this Sunday's gospel back in with last Sunday's gospel to make room for this one. Because I thought it ought to get read once in a while and get commented on. It's an interesting story. But before we look at the story, look at where it sits. It's immediately after the second prediction of the Passion. Now, you remember Mark's outline. Each of the three predictions of the Passion is followed by a major screw-up by the disciples and then by further teaching by Jesus. Well, Matthew is not quite as interested in presenting all the foibles of the disciples. So he takes out the story of them fighting over which one of them is the greatest and puts this in. I mean, he's working a different outline. He's doing the five narratives, five sermons outline. And this is the end of the narrative for the fourth sermon. Very next verses, the beginning of chapter 18, are the sermon on the church. So this is the last of his narratives before the sermon on the church. Should give us an indication of what it is he's trying to accomplish with this passage. Why isn't it read more often? Well, I suspect perhaps because it's a folktale. And it's fairly obviously a folktale. And people were afraid that people weren't quite ready for folktales in the gospel. That if people heard folktales in the gospel, they might think a whole gospel was a folktale. Well, I think we're a little more sophisticated about our literary forms than that around here. And we can tolerate Matthew's folktales without questioning the other kinds of literature he presents. And in fact, looking for the truth inside the folktales. Frequently there's wonderful truth buried inside folktales. And I think there is here too. It's not a simple folktale. One with a lot of parallels. The rabbis have a couple of similar stories in the Talmud. There are stories in Egypt like this. There are stories in Greece like this. There are stories in Persia like this. I think almost any culture around them had a magic fish story or two. Woman loses ring, buys fish at market, finds ring in gullet of fish. Philosopher throws his last coin into the ocean. Somebody gives him a fish. He opens the fish and there's a coin. It goes around. It's used for different things in different cultures, but it's a common story. But not without its sophistication. We smooth it out following the sort of narrative approach of the English language in translation. But in Greek, it's really pretty elegant. It's four matched pairs, an aorist participle and an aorist imperative. Aorist participle, aorist imperative, bang, 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 bang. Going, cast a hook, first coming up, take, opening its mouth, find, taking, give. Very elegantly done, but still a folktale. Now, what is that doing here, and what claim does it have to historicity? Well, to answer the last question first, probably very little. Folktales are not generally historical. But the preceding dialogue may be a different answer. Listen to this. From whom do the kings of the earth take toll or tribute? From their children or from foreigners? Then the children are exempt. Doesn't that sound like Jesus? Doesn't that sound like the kind of debate method, teaching method he uses frequently with the disciples, with the Pharisees, with the scribes? A lot of scholars suggest that this dialogue is authentic Jesus material to which the folktale has been added. That raises an interesting thought, huh? What is Jesus saying here, and why is he saying it? Well, the temple tax was a half shekel a year that every Jewish male over a certain age paid every year for the support of the temple in Jerusalem. It was not, however, totally observed. There are some people who would argue that really only the Pharisees and the Hasidim, the really devout, paid the temple tax by this time. Jesus is a leader of his followers. Peter is asked, doesn't your master pay the temple tax? Isn't he one of the pious ones? Isn't he one of the Pharisees? Isn't he one of the Hasids? Where's the money? Interesting question. Jesus, in reply, asks a more interesting question. Who is God? This is very much along Jesus' traditional teaching lines. That while he acknowledges God as king, God is primarily parent. God is mother. God is father. Do parents take taxes from their children? No. Right? Generally, the allowance flows the other way. Then the children are exempt. This fits with his idea of God. It fits with his idea of himself as son of God. Fits with his idea of his disciples as the daughters and sons of God. And all leads to the idea that they have no obligation to pay this tax. But, he says, and this is translated, but that we may not offend them. The Greek is that we may not scandalize them, that we may not be an obstacle for them, that we may not be a stumbling block for them. And then we go into the fish story. Well, the fish story is obviously added. But unless it's completely reversed, the whole tenor of the teaching, the rest of the teaching must have said something like, but lest we scandalize them, go pay it anyway. And then they snipped off a little bit and put on the fish story because it made it a more interesting story. So we have Jesus paying a tax for the support of the temple, which he doesn't feel he has any obligation to pay. Why? To maintain the unity of the Jewish community. To maintain his standing among the Hasidim. To maintain the standing of his disciples among the Pharisees. It's important that we stand together. We're in an occupied country. We need to be together. We will stretch things in order to be together. We will pay a tax that we really have no obligation to pay in order to maintain the unity of the Jewish people. That's Jesus' dialogue in the 30s. Sometime in the 50s or 60s, the magic fish story gets added to add a little more drama to the story. But then in the year 70, there's the Jewish war, the revolt. The Romans win. They tear down the temple and build a pagan temple on its site, the Temple of Jupiter Capitolinus. And now, the tax, still imposed on Jews by the Romans, the Fiscus Judaicus, goes to Jerusalem for the support of this pagan temple. Not something anybody approves of. 15 years later, Matthew is writing his gospel. Why does he preserve this story? It wasn't in Mark. He has to deliberately, do some cutting and splicing on Mark to put it in there. He goes out of his way to preserve this story. Why does he do it? After all, who wants to pay the temple tax now? Matthew is arguing, we do. He's arguing that just as Jesus paid it back in the 30s, we should pay it in the 80s. Even though we're not obliged to, and even though we're totally opposed to what the money's actually being used for, we should pay the tax. Because it identifies us as Jews. It provides us unity with our sisters and brothers. At this point in Jewish Christian history, remember, we're about halfway through the cell division process. The nuclei have separated. You've got the rabbis on one side and the apostles on the other. But there's only one cell wall. Matthew's own community is heavily Jewish. Matthew is a well-instructed rabbi himself. They're taking in more and more Gentiles, and other parts of the gospel deal with this. Why and how and under what circumstances and whatnot should we take in Gentiles? but it has strong, proud Jewish roots. And Matthew wants to keep them. He said, if the break comes, let it not be on our side. And let it not be over something trivial as this. No, we're not obliged to pay the tax. No, we could say we're not Jews anymore, we're Christians. And the Romans wouldn't insist that we pay the tax. No, we don't approve of what the tax is being used for. But pay the damn tax. Maintain our unity with our Jewish sisters and brothers. It's important. It was important for Jesus. It was important for Matthew. I think it's important for us. It's an analogous situation. I mean, Christianity and Judaism have long gone separate ways. We're not talking about that issue. But we are talking about maintaining unity in the Christian community, keeping our people together, and being willing to make some sacrifices to do it. There's a real advantage to being a very large family. We have a little bit of clout in the world. We provide a visible center for the rallying of the ecumenical movement. There's a lot of things that go with being a big church. But to be a big church, like to be a big family, we have people from all places and all cultures and all points of the ideological spectrum. If your family reunion is big enough, you probably can't talk politics or religion at the family reunion without starting a fight. Same way here. We can start some fights. And sometimes we need to start some fights, but we need to keep them within the family. We need to stand up for what we believe in, need to advocate for the direction we think the church should go, but we need to keep it within the church because that's our strength. That's the way that we leverage the gospel. Remember, the gospel is not here for me. It's not here for you. It's not here for the church. It's here for the world. The church is not the end of the gospel, but the church is supposed to be God's tool for the proclamation of the gospel and the building of the kingdom. And keeping our ranks together, keeping the bonds of the family, is important in preserving our strength and our leverage in working God's peace and justice in the world. So we pay some prices. Sometimes they're personal, sometimes they're communal. Sometimes they're trivial. Sometimes they're pretty heavy. A couple of months ago, I went to a wedding of a friend of mine as a guest because I couldn't go as the presider because we don't do those kind of weddings, at least not yet. But I went as a guest and didn't preside. I preserved the discipline of the church, even though I disagreed with it. There's currently a big fight going on about the translation of the sacramentary. Rome wants to retranslate all the prayers into a much more slavish translation of the Latin original. And people among our bishops have been leading a fight against it, saying, it's really not good English. I mean, it's just not. We may win. We may lose. We'll fight the action on it. And if we lose, we'll fight the rear guard. We'll delay the implementation as much as possible. I'll tell the liturgical office downtown that, of course, we will buy a new sacramentary as soon as we need one. Since our sacristan takes very good care of our books, I expect to need one in about 32 years. But if push comes to shove and we get direct orders from downtown, we'll buy the book. We'll use at least some of the new translations. We'll stretch, in other words, to accommodate our unity with the rest of the church. And the stretching is not all from our direction either, Do you know how many really solid conservatives are stretching just to tolerate us? It has to go that way in a family. We all stretch for each other. And it all goes back, I think, to this precedent. From whom do kings of the earth take tax or tribute? Then the children are exempt. Yep. We are. But go take the magic fish and pay the damn tax anyway. Don't have to like it, but we have to do it. It doesn't say we always have to do it. You know, there are times, there are moments for individuals and communities where you say, I really can't cross this line. You know? There are here stay issues, kindness unders, Luther's famous here I stand, I can do no other moments. We have to be prepared to suffer those as well, and that's a whole different kind of suffering. But they should be rare for individuals and for communities. We really ought to stretch ourselves as far as we can to accommodate each other, to preserve the strength of the community, because it is in that community that we have our strength for our purpose, which is to accomplish the mission, to bring the gospel to the world. One rolling stream may be harder to get moving, but it moves a lot more dirt than a dozen little creeks. If we keep the community together, we can accomplish more. And that's what we're sent here to do. And that's why it's important, I think, to follow this precedent. So think about the magic fish story once in a while. It's, you know, the addition of the folktale surely does make it a memorable story, doesn't it? You know? And think about Peter opening this fish and taking the coin, paying the tax. The tax that Jesus said we really don't have to pay, but we pay it anyway. Sisters and brothers, let us pray.